Good morning, everyone. Today's date is February 18th, 2020, and you are listening to episode 8 of Coronavirus Central, your daily source of information about the novel coronavirus of 2019, the viral infection known as SARS-2-nCoV, and called the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm your host, Tom Kaczynski, and today we're going to talk about the number of cases. More information about the outbreak. Specifically, we're going to look at some of the supply chain vulnerabilities and follow up on yesterday's episode where we were taking a look at what the public social media response has been to this, as well as what we are seeing in the broader network. We'll talk about other rumors that are out there, how we're having to collect information. And as always, we try to offer some helpful advice to protect you and your family. The podcast represents the combined effort of a public open source information network, which we invite you to join. If you want to actively participate, join us at t.me/coronaviruscentral. We have all the podcasts up at coronaviruscentral.net, and these are being streamed across iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and YouTube. And if you have information about what's happening or questions, please send it to coronaviruscentral@pm.me. We are an independent organization working to seek the truth internationally and for the safety of all against this pandemic as we seek better information. So thank you for listening, and as always, thank you for tuning in. I want to thank all of our new listeners. I saw yesterday we cracked 1,000 listeners for the first time, and I'm very flattered and grateful that you are using this podcast as a source of information. And we're going to try our best to walk the line between giving you accurate information and trying to figure out what is happening out here. Because one of the problems we're running into, just so you know, is that the media is trying very hard to blockade what information is going out. And this is a major problem for us. Because our basic orientation is that we look at the events on the ground that are happening, and we see, you know, the fact that now a tenth of humanity is under quarantine, and yet we're told this isn't worse than the flu. One of these things just doesn't fit, but unfortunately, there are a lot of powerful actors whom I hope are working in our best interest, but at least that they achieve something, because they're keeping a lot of things quiet from us. And we'll go into an example of that later in the show today, about just how oppressive the media silence is getting. And if it seems like you're listening to this podcast at a time when the news is covering this less and less clearly, I think that in and of itself is somewhat telling that, you know, there seems to be a mass media gag order out there. And we've seen from previous events that is a common practice. So we will continue broadcasting and try to seek out the best information. It would be better if we had more sources honestly and accurately reporting. Right now, we do not. So we're going to have to, you know, just look around and try to make some intelligent assessments. And if you find things and you hear things, let us know. Because, frankly, we the people are going to have to count on one another if we're going to survive this until, you know, it reaches a point where things are so bad that the deceit goes away and that we will have to then deal with the consequences of this in mutual safety for one another. But today's show, as promised, is going to talk in a great deal of detail about questions about the supply chain. And for those who have just started following this, one of the, of course, the primary concern with the COVID-19 outbreak has been that we are worried about the health, we are worried about the risks of infection, the viral pneumonia we've talked about, the risk of secondary infection, or I should say reinfection, that you get this cytokine storm where healthy people have their immune systems attack their own body, leading to various problems, including, but not necessarily limited to, heart failure. We're waiting for research to come out on that in more detail. Unfortunately, it's going to take a little time, so we're having to make some assessments based on what we saw in SARS. And I think that's a good way to go with this, because the International Committee for the Taxonomy of Viruses said, the people who name viruses, said this is basically a SARS reflux. It's a new virus, obviously, but it's in the SARS family. And so I think that taxonomy, that categorization, make it such that we will have to look at that to govern sort of our ideas of what's possible. And SARS had a problem with a vaccine where it caused an immune response because of the angiotensin-converting enzyme pathway. That's all big talk. To make it very small, the problem is that the same thing that basically regulates how your blood pressure works can get attacked by your immune system because the entry means of this coronavirus uses the same methodology, and your body can get confused and it can mess up blood regulation, which is not something you want to mess up, obviously, because every part of your body needs blood, right? But as we go forward from that, and we'll talk about that a lot more, the thing that's equally valid that we need to worry about is collateral damage and secondary actions. And really by that I mean the fact that you have major parts of the world not working. You have quarantines throughout China and starting to get into other countries. We know now of a quarantine in Vietnam of 10,000 people that's existing for 30 days. And we see that beginning to spread. We saw that Israel, in fact, yesterday banned people entering their country from Singapore, Hong Kong, Thailand, and Macau. And I think we will see that continue to expand. I think Japan, Taiwan, other countries will be included in that as we see the outbreak starting to expand there in Asia. And we'll try to cover that in more detail later this week, as well as take a look at the ongoing problems of the Diamond Princess, where the latest number now has, what were we going to say, about 10% of the people on there, not including those that came back to the United States, which include 14 infected individuals from what's been reported coming back here. Definitely a lot of sick people on that ship, and it speaks to the high infectivity and danger of that virus. And potentially it's aerosolization. I know that's something that is still a bit controversial, but it seems like the evidence is such that we should look at it that way. But as we go through it today, we're going to talk about the supply chains, because as all those people aren't working, as ships aren't moving, as people are afraid of things happening, what happens is that our global logistics system begins to break down, and that the goods we are used to getting from point A to point B do not arrive on time, or and supplies get exhausted. And just like in the same way that an automobile, you know, it won't function without gas, but it won't function without a battery, it won't function without oil to lubricate the engine or, you know, transmission fluid. There are any number of different key critical nodes in a system needed to make a complex economy work. And whether it's a car or whether it's world finance, the fundamental nature of it stays the same. And what we find and what today we're going to talk about are some of those critical sectors in a little more detail about why there are going to be problems there, and try to forecast as best we can what kind of time frame it's going to be before these problems become real issues, where, you know, if you wait, you know, an extra 100, 200 miles for your oil change, your car will probably run. Whereas if you run your oil 10,000 miles on a 3,000 mile oil, you're probably going to have a major problem. And we can offer some assessments of that. So we're definitely going to do that today, and we'll look at a couple different sectors. But before we get into that, let's start with what we usually like to do here at the beginning. And we're going to go through, these are the confirmed cases that are publicly announced. As always, we say that these numbers are, you know, to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt, especially for China, just because there's so much evidence that these numbers are wrong. But now, we'll leave that for the time being. So the numbers as of the moment are that we have, and this is at 7:10 a.m. on February 18th, COVID-19info.live, which collates from the World Health Organization, basically. We have 73,336 confirmed cases, 1,874 deaths, 13,064 recoveries. Now, the numbers for confirmed cases: mainland China, 72,438. Japan, 520. Although keep in mind, over 400 of those are related to the ship. Nonetheless, we are seeing some spread on the Japanese mainland, and that should be concerning. Singapore, 77. Hong Kong, 61. Thailand, 35. South Korea, 31. Malaysia, 22. Taiwan, 22. And then it looks like anything beyond that is just reporting in 20 or less. I don't know if that's accurate or not. We really just don't know for a number of different reasons. So we'll leave that be for the time being. But those are the numbers of the day. And I'm going to start with an article from Zero Hedge. Zero Hedge has been out in front of this for a while. They've been a website that does a lot of financial analysis, but they're willing to go ahead and ask some tougher questions. Tyler Durden does a good job with that. And in fact, they've been banned from Twitter for supposedly spawning fake news. Although their approach for a lot of this in the article we're going to read today is based on evidence. However, it's evidence that does not fit the public narrative. And that's something I want you to think about, is that do you want to judge based on the authority of the media sources which are coming to you, or do you want to judge based on facts that are presented before you? So this article was from Saturday, but it's still very relevant for what we're talking about today, and that's supply chain issues. And I want to just offer some information from this. And the article from Tyler Durden says, China is disintegrating. Steel demand, property sales, and traffic are all approaching zero. And over this, he wrote, in our ongoing attempts to glean some objective insight into what is happening on the ground in the notoriously opaque China, whose economy has been hammered by the coronavirus epidemic, yesterday we showed several alternative economic indicators, such as real-time measurements of air pollution as a proxy for industrial output, daily coal consumption, a proxy for electricity usage and manufacturing, and traffic congestion levels, a proxy for commerce and mobility, before concluding that China's economy appears to have ground to a halt. That conclusion was cemented after looking at some other real-time charts, which suggest there's a very high probability that China's GDP in Q1 will not only flatline, but crater deep into the red for one simple reason. There is no economic activity taking place whatsoever. We start with China's infrastructure and fixed asset investment, which until recently counted for the bulk of Chinese GDP. As Goldman writes in an overnight report, in the February 7th to 13th week, steel apparent demand is down a whopping 40%, but that's only because flat steel is down only 12%, as some car plants have ordered their employees to return to work against their will, potentially, as epidemics are still raging. And they offer a number of charts for this. We'll have a link to this, and they'll have a link to the previous articles. But just so you can know, when we're looking at these, what we see is that air pollution has gone down incredibly, coal consumption is down incredibly, and the traffic congestion is down. And you can have anecdotal evidence of this. Just look at the different Chinese cities in lockdown, and you'll see people aren't going to work, which actually is kind of a curious thing, because the counter argument that's been made against the case that a few people have made about the sulfur dioxide boom that we saw in Wuhan was saying that, oh, this could be other economic activity. But, and you know, because sulfur dioxide is released from the breaking of organic bonds, and some people have suggested that a mass crematorium could be there. So if you, for the people who say this wasn't the case, then it's a curious thing that there'd be one place producing all this economic activity when the rest of the economy is shut down, yet we have this happening during a quarantine. Just so something to think about in the back of your head. But he shows a number of charts here, and these just show that the usage is way down of steel for construction. And as we go through this, I'm not going to read everything, but if you look at the congestion levels, he shows us that it's down. Passenger travel is down about 80%. Passenger traffic is down 70%, almost 80% as well. And you can see this over and over again. Coal consumption has gone from a peak of, let's call it 200 in the way this charts to 50, so it's now at 75%. And this is the most interesting thing, perhaps, is as the economy craters and internal supply chains fray, prices for everyday staples such as food are soaring. And that, in fact, this equals, now it's at 115% of the base price of what people expect to pay. And usually, just to give you a historical model, the prices usually go up for food around Lunar New Year's. That's like a big deal over there in China. It's like their Christmas. And historically, it's down to about 100% by now. It's up to 115 and still rising. And there's other things out there. We've seen different videos, and China's even reported on this, that there's been mass killing of pigs, of birds, because with the immunocompromised population, as well as potential outbreaks of H1N1, the bird flu, that we have seen that China's access to food supply is becoming, in fact, perilous in some ways. Between the lack of feed coming in for industrial workers, there are these videos. They're terrible to watch, but they're out there where they literally take thousands or tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands, it's impossible to tell the numbers, of livestock who they simply cannot feed, and they're just burying them in pits. And of course, people need to be fed, right? I mean, even during the middle of this pandemic, but the supply chains internal to China really aren't working that well, and they don't have that big of a reservoir of items. So from the purposes of human suffering, the likelihood of a famine is very challenging here. And if we look based on the estimates of what's happening with the Chinese GDP, just on the numbers, the chart is showing that we are going to recognize a major drop. China historically has averaged about 6-7% economic growth per year, at least from a raw financial perspective. And that this year, this quarter at least, it looks like they are going to be losing. And that has huge consequences because when things aren't being made and you have an area that is meeting global supply, there's a lot of issues that come out of that. And so we talked about China just for a second because it's important for you to understand the extent of the suffering there. And in fact, they are now, from what I've read, importing $60 billion is what it would work out to annually of American agriculture. The recent trade deal with the Trump administration, that phase one signed, opened up China to American livestock. And in fact, we are beginning to send food to them because they do not have the ability to feed themselves at this point. And that's a major concern. And we'll see how that impacts the economics all around, as well as food prices here domestically, because there's going to be increased global demand. And it's not the topic of today's show, but, you know, there's a major locust plague basically eating a lot of the crops throughout the Middle East and East Africa. There's an issue with H5N8 bird flu in Germany. There's all these things happening worldwide that is threatening major sources of food provision worldwide, as well as the weather patterns, which have been wetter than farmers would have liked. All of these things in aggregate are making it where food supplies are more stressed, demand is increased, and the costs are likely to rise. So keep an eye on that when you go to the supermarket. That's going to be a major concern moving forward. And regardless of how this resolves itself, I suspect this year food prices are going to be up, and the early indicators hint at that. So we're going to go into the detail now that you kind of understand China's problem a little bit. And we see cases where, you know, there is a push in some areas to put people back to work. And you watch these videos of people going in there looking like they're going into a hazmat room to go work at an office desk. I don't know how viable that is. I don't know how much that's going to spread the coronavirus, because we see the example of a quarantined ship where literally now a tenth of the people have this thing, and perhaps more. We don't really know. So I think it's incredibly dangerous that they're choosing to prioritize the economy over public health. Nonetheless, if they don't have a degree of economic development, and this is the curse that governments face, they might reach a spot where they can't meet their basic supply needs. And it's, if you think about it from that perspective, as I think our government and most Western governments are, that is one of the reasons why I suspect we are dealing with an information blackout, because they do not want us to know these things. Because if we start acting, you know, rationally for ourselves, which they would call a panic, the supply chains would break down here. So this piece I'm sharing with you now is from CNBC, who usually does decent market coverage, and it's just sort of an introductory thing to what the consequences of coronavirus might be. It was written by Elliot Smith on Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern, and it says coronavirus could impact 5 million companies worldwide, new research shows. I'll just read a little bit of this. The new coronavirus outbreak and subsequent shutdown of huge swaths of China could impact more than 5 million businesses worldwide, according to a new study. A special briefing issued by global data analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, and just for a little background, because I used to work in logistics, they are the ones who basically assign numbers for categorizing how international trade moves. So these guys really know their stuff. If anyone would, Dun & Bradstreet's who you'd want to listen to, because it's their job to know that. Anyway, they analyzed the Chinese provinces most impacted by the virus and found they are intricately linked to the global business network. The affected areas with 100 or more confirmed cases as of February 5th are home to over 90% of all active businesses in China, according to the report, and around 49,000 businesses in this region are branches and subsidiaries of foreign companies. Almost half, 49%, of the companies with subsidiaries in impacted regions are headquartered in Hong Kong, while the U.S. accounts for 19%, Japan 12%, and Germany 5%. As of Monday, over 70,000 cases of the virus have been confirmed in China, resulting in 1,770 deaths, according to the Chinese National Health Commission. Okay, and that number's gone up, obviously. But here's the more interesting part for what we are talking about. Dun and Bradstreet researchers found that at least 51,000 companies worldwide, 163 of which are in the Fortune 1000, have one or more direct or tier one suppliers in the impacted region, while at least 5,938,000 in the Fortune 1000 have one or more tier two suppliers. So just to put that mumbo jumbo into English, tier one is a supplier who is essential to your supply chain, which is to say that if you made bicycles and only one company could make the tires you need, that'd be a tier one supplier. But if you had your pedals on your bike with three companies could make, that might be a tier two supplier where it's not as essential. It's a part you use, but there are alternatives. And so what this is telling you is that 16.3% of the biggest businesses in the world have utterly essential parts, which can only come as of right now from China, and that those are going to be impacted. Whereas, while 93.8% get at least part of what they use from China. And to keep in mind, this is an important thing as we talk about this. Even if there are alternatives in theory that can be used, if all 93% who were using, you know, let's say a Foxconn, which produces a lot of the electronic components around the world, go to whatever an Indian or, you know, a German, Japanese equivalent, they're not going to be able to handle that volume. They're not even going to be close because the supply chains aren't set up that way. And it takes a lot of infrastructure to do this. That's why people go to China. They have a lot of people, really big businesses, and can do certain things well. In time, can these be replaced? Yes. But if you need something in 3 weeks and it's going to take 3 months to build a factory, assuming you can even get the raw materials, that's a big problem. So definitely don't overlook the tier two suppliers. So the impact on businesses in China and around the world is already dragging down economic growth forecasts for the year. In a research note published Monday, Moody's, and that's just the credit ratings, revised down its global growth forecast by 0.2 percentage point, expecting G20 economies to collectively grow at a rate of 2.4 in 2020, with China slipping to 5.2%. This assumes a baseline forecast that the spread of the virus is contained by the end of first quarter, that's by saying March 30th, restoring normal economic activity in the second quarter. However, the global economic toll would be, quote, severe, end quote, if the rate of infection and rising death toll do not abate, with international supply chains amplifying the shock. And we'll just go over here. The Dun and Bradstreet report that identified that the top five major sectors accounting for more than 80% of businesses within impacted provinces were services, wholesale trade, manufacturing, retail, and financial services. And that's not surprising. China is largely a producing economy that produces material goods that are used in larger sales elsewhere. And the impacted provinces of Guangdong, Jiangsu, Zhejiang, Beijing, and Shandong account for 50% of the total employment and 48% of the total sales of the Chinese economy. The Chinese economy also accounts for 20% of global GDP, and analysts estimated that if the containment outbreak is delayed beyond the summer, the cascading effect might cause a drag of around 1% around global GDP growth. And the rest of this article, there's only a little bit left, we'll skip over that. It's just saying that as the Chinese economy falls, and as goods aren't available, there's going to be all sorts of problems. And there's two sets of problems that come out of this that you need to be aware of. Well, three sets, really. The first set, the most obvious, is you can't get what you need, right? If you need electronics, if you need pharmaceuticals, if you need these certain key sectors that are heavily invested in China, you're not going to be able to get that. Furthermore, if you work for a company, especially if you are a small business that does sort of industrial work or anything in electronics, you are already starting to see layoffs and cutbacks and things happen at the periphery. I've read at least 4 or 5 different anecdotal cases of smaller firms who've had to shut down business and put people on furlough for a time because they do not have access to the goods by which to provide supplies. The third thing, and this is not being covered in here, but it is really, really important, and I'll try to do a show about it maybe by the end of the week. It's kind of complex, but is that so much of how global finance works is under the assumption that things will exist as normal. If, in fact, that there is significant retraction in any of a number of different areas, including Wall Street, and, you know, when we look at those Fortune 1000 companies, you're talking about Apple, you're talking about Amazon, you're talking about Walmart, you're talking about companies whose supply chains are incredibly heavily dependent on China. What happens is when that sell-off starts, there are a number of financial investment instruments that basically piggyback on where you could end up having a global depression. And of course, part of that goes to the coronavirus and the harmful effect on human life itself. But another big part of it, in the same way that happened in 2007, for those who remember the bailout crisis of the banks, is that banks are still doing the same irresponsible behaviors. You can check out the Atlantis report if you want a more in-depth coverage of this, and I'll put a link to that website into this article just for those who are interested in this. But the derivative practice of basically betting on things to succeed or fail and using the debt itself as collateral has continued. The banks learned nothing, and that in the West we see that our quote-unquote consumer economies are once again in a credit bubble. Part of this, instead of being mortgage debt, is now back to being consumer debt, as well as assuming that the market will perpetually grow. And what we have seen in the early moments of this crisis, especially from the Chinese central bank, but increasingly from Western central banks, is to keep the economy afloat, they have dumped basically a bunch of money in the economy. And if you look at how hot the stock market's performing, including in the best tell of this is the airline sector, where they're cutting 30-40% of their routes, and yet the stock prices keep going up. It is an artificial bubble that's being held up by one, central bank investment, and two, AI trading that is acting on trends rather than acting rationally based on information on the ground. Because all micro trading in the stock market basically looks for certain patterns that tend to reflect rational behaviors. But when you have irrational actors acting certain ways, that's when you can end up with a major depression akin to 1929. And if this virus continues for an extended length of time, if the supply chains don't renew, there is a real possibility we go down that path. And I'm not saying this just to scare you. I'm simply saying you can't have an economy continue making money where no goods are being produced. At some point, that breakdown ends up being a big issue. So we'll talk about the finance of it another day, but it's important you be aware of it. And now I want to go into some of the detailed vulnerabilities here. And this article was published in Stat News. This was from February 14th, and we're going to start by talking about pharma because I think that it's probably the area that we should be most concerned about in the short term. The coronavirus outbreak exposes the U.S. pharma supply chain vulnerability, and like I said, this is Marsha Blackburn. So, in the 21st century, Americans have found it far too easy to be complacent about public health emergencies like the ongoing coronavirus outbreak that began in China and has since spread to other countries, including the United States. To be fair, it has been more than 50 years since the last federal quarantine was issued to control a deadly smallpox outbreak. A half-century gap is bound to instill a false sense of security, even when taking more recent threats into consideration. So, let's see. I'm just going to skip here. In October 2019, Dr. Janet Woodcock, director of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, testified before Congress that the United States has become a world leader in drug discovery and development, but is no longer in the forefront of drug manufacturing. Woodcock identified as a key health and security concern the cessation of U.S. manufacturing of active pharmaceutical ingredients, APIs, the basic building blocks of medications. She testified that 72% of API manufacturing takes place outside of the U.S. and that the number of facilities making APIs in China has more than doubled since 2010. The use of foreign sourced materials creates vulnerabilities in the U.S. supply chain. Her concerns are not unfounded. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission echoed Woodcock's worries. In its 2019 report to Congress, the commission revealed serious deficiencies in health and safety standards in China's pharmaceutical network. So the rest of this talks about how there are these problems of China. And this is an interesting part. We'll pull this out. In 2016, an explosion at a Chinese factory resulted in a global shortage of piperacillin, an important antibiotic, simply because that factory was the drug's sole source of production. And we've had cases, this article goes on and talks about contamination and different things that happen. And as we understand, a lot of what happens in the global supply chain is corporations that are trying to maximize their profit margin go to countries that have less strict regulatory regimes. And when it comes to chemical production, there's often a trade-off between yield and safety. And China, along with other second and third world countries, has been known to have more lax regulations so they can produce more. Unfortunately, you know, there's two parts to that. One is there's this risk of contamination, which has happened a number of times, and this article talks about. But secondly, we have seen so much offshored in this. And the article goes through just talking about the problems of relying on China. But to go to the numbers of this, I mean, in the United States now, and we've talked about this. This is from a CFR article that we talked about. I think it was in episode 2 or maybe it was episode 3. And what it was saying was that 97% of our antibiotics come from China. 90% come, generic drugs come through there. And of the places that come elsewhere, these active pharmaceutical ingredients come from other places. And we have another article on this. We'll talk about that. And this is from February 11th, and it's from The Conversation. I don't have an author's name, but there's multiple authors. Christine Crudo Blackburn, let's see, Andrew Natsios, Gerald W. Parker, and Leslie Royal. The silent threat of the coronavirus, America's dependence on Chinese pharmaceuticals. And it talks about the potential dangers of this. It talks about Chinese dominance in the pharmaceutical market and says 80% of pharmaceuticals are produced in the United or in China. And this number, while concerning, hides an even greater problem. China is the largest and sometimes only global supplier for the active ingredient of some vital medications. They give some examples. The active ingredients for medicines that treat breast cancer and lung cancer, and the antibiotic vancomycin, which is a last resort antibiotic for some types of antimicrobial resistant infections, are made almost exclusively in China. Additionally, China controls such a large market portion of heparin, a blood thinner used in open heart surgery, kidney dialysis, and blood transfusions, that the U.S. government was left with no choice but to continue buying from China, even after a contamination scandal in 2007. China is not only the dominant global supplier of pharmaceuticals, but it is also the largest supplier of medical devices in the U.S. These things include things like MRI equipment, surgical gown, and equipment that measures oxygen levels in the blood. Supplies of these essential products have not yet been severely disrupted by the coronavirus, but if China is no longer will or is able to supply them to the U.S., thousands of Americans could die. And as they note, is when a disease reaches epidemic levels, the first obligation for leaders in any country is to protect their own people. As this current crisis progresses, there may come a point when political leaders in China will face decisions on whether to prohibit the export of pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and other vital medical components in order to treat or protect their own people. Such acts would be the logical outcome of an escalating situation. And we have an example of this because for the 2009 H1N1 pandemic response, for example, the U.S. was pushed to the back of the queue for vaccine deliveries, even though we had existing contracts with a major vaccine manufacturer located in another country. Those vaccine deliveries were delayed. So China's got a major problem, right? They got all these problems. They need drugs. And if they figure out if it's one of the antivirals that helps, if they need antibiotics for secondary action, any of these things, they are going to, and they should, honestly, begin producing for the welfare and safety of their own people having this terrible epidemic. The problem is, what happens to us when people start taking care of their own? And China's going to do this. What we are seeing and what this article indicates is just a couple of the areas. And frankly, we don't know the areas because corporations are being incredibly cagey because they don't want to lose their market value about sharing what things are going to be up impacted, but like they said, heparin's an example. A number of antibiotics are an example. The saline production is an example. What we're going to see is at the very time that demand will be inclining, the ability to provide better service medically for not just for coronavirus patients and these sort of expensive HIV-opposing antivirals that we've seen like Remdesivir and all these things, they are not going to be available. Not only that, but basic medication won't be available, and that is very concerning. So the article goes through and talks about the weaknesses in the protection sector of China and what could go wrong, but I think that those are things that you need to be aware of. And so when we look at this case of the medical situation, what it seems to be, and this is a general statement, is that the nature of the supply chain is they have something, they call it 30-90-180. And so they try to have a 30-day supply for most things. So expect 4 weeks to be the sort of window during which we will be able to get goods. And just so the usual cross-Pacific transit and unloading is about 14 days. So you really have something closer to 45 days in the best case scenario for a lot of goods. So assuming that, let's use when the breakdown started in China, the quarantine was declared in Wuhan January 23rd. What that means is roughly by the end of February, about 2 weeks from now, it should probably become really evident how much the supply disruptions are hurting the rest of the world. In some places, it's already recognized, and that's one of the reasons why the government is trying to prevent panic shopping, which you should be doing, by the way, but they are trying to prevent that because these supply chain problems, the fact that ships just are not moving across the Pacific or the Atlantic with the numbers you would expect, are going to become manifest then, and we're going to have major critical shortages recur in March, and if things are not fixed by very soon, in the next couple weeks, those shortages will become critical. And that's assuming that we don't have a coronavirus outbreak in the West, which is runs against all evidence and the assessment that we are offering in this show. So you need to be aware of that. And then further out, what you will find is things that are not domestically produced are going to begin falling off the chain. I've looked at a number of different things. The shipping lanes are shut down. Trucks will end up getting shut down in a lot of places because you'll have quarantine issues that will stop food supplies. And a lot of the supplies are reliant in the United States on something called just-in-time logistics. And what it basically does is it saves money by having things coordinated in central locations, but it has a strategic vulnerability where essentially, the best way to put it is 95% of your food supply arrives from more than 150 days away and has a 3-day shelf life. Not great situation. And we don't have redundant, diversified agriculture. So if you live in a place, say you're in New York or a big city, an urban environment where you're not near, food supplies that are sufficient for your community, and there is a logistical breakdown that happens from a quarantine, which, whether it was announced or not, you're going to have absenteeism. I mean, if you knew you were likely to get sick, would you go somewhere? Perhaps not. I wouldn't. And those are some of the things that are coming down the line. And we can, so those are a little further down the line, but let's just talk about what we're facing right now, and we'll go from there. So this is from Material Handling and Logistics. It's a trade organization and media network that talks about the issues of coronavirus on the global supply chain. And this article is from their staff. It's called The Impact of Coronavirus on Global Supply Chain. And they say, those companies who identify specific supply risks and actively manage it will find solutions or at least mitigate the impact, says Hackett Group. Those that don't are at the mercy of the virus and the public response. And they went through different critical supply areas, and they were saying that what you need to do is you need to find capacity of people who can pick up your needs, and that you need to be looking actively beyond your first-tier suppliers. The problem, as we know, is that there are certain products that are basically only made in China because of the cost-effectiveness. And they rated those industries that landed in the highest risk category include tools and hardware, so, it's basic manufacturing, electronics and appliances. A ton of that comes from Shenzhen. That's basically China next to Hong Kong. Auto parts, OEM. And we already see plants are closing. Hyundai plant is down. I know GM plants are starting to slow down. There's a number of auto parts that just cannot be produced. So car parts is going to be a big thing that gets hurt here. Building products, a lot of steel beams are produced there. diversified chemical, that's pharmaceuticals as well as other ones, and industrial specialties. So big production is going to go down, and that's really a huge problem, because if you work for a big company like that, you're going to be among the first hit, and we've already seen that. It's hitting more in Asia than in the U.S., and there just aren't the alternative suppliers here. I mean, some of the onshoring that has happened, thanks at least in part to the revitalized effort towards nationalism, will offset a little bit of this, but there isn't the, what they call it, surge capacity to cover all that. So you need to be aware of those things. And there's just other articles. I'm not going to read them all because we're too deep into this, but I'll just read some headlines, and then you can hunt these down yourself if you want. The Wall Street Journal published on the 14th, coronavirus creates domino effect in global automotive supply chain. Fiat Chrysler plan to shut down in Europe while GM production outages threatened in the U.S. Apparently, they're about a week or two from realizing those. Fierce Pharma produces concern for drug shortages as COVID-19 outbreak goes on. And in this article, it mentions that they are looking for alternate suppliers to make up shortfalls. But in this case, it may be hard to do because China makes up those ingredients and therefore the generic drugs that make up 90% of the drug supply. India, which is the second largest producer of drugs, gets 2/3 of its ingredients from China. And the other issue is that there are issues related to this with UPS and other goods being able to be safely handled. So a lot of big problems. The Financial Times had an article, which I'm now blocked from seeing behind a paywall, but it says drug makers brace for coronavirus disruptions to China supplies. And this week, we are being told that Chinese are supposed to go back to work, but just last night, there was a story that broke, and I think I have it here. Coronavirus, this is from 9 to 5 Mac, coronavirus will be expected to severely hit laptop production, will be 1/3 down. And in this, it said, Apple's primary iPhone assembler, Foxconn, has been struggling with production levels, with its biggest plant only 10% staffed as of last week. They were wanting to come back, but Apple reported last night, actually, that they're not going to be able to do it. And Apple's stock went down, I think, 3 or 4 points in the overnight trading. But that, or 3 or 4%, I should say. And the problem is they're not going to be able to come back online that quickly unless they want to risk getting everyone sick. And we talk about this thing with reinfection. This idea that the market is factoring in that this disruption will be short is, I think, unduly optimistic and does not fit the biological evidence on the ground. So let's go on to the next one here. We've got Bloomberg, China virus crisis, royal supply chains for global manufacturers. Same thing. Toyota and Honda having extended shutdowns. Foxconn having a shutdown. These are big companies that are being affected, but it's smaller companies that also have parts. And this goes into a lot of detail on Foxconn. But it also says that there's a real short on woven fabric supplies. Apparently, that's another big sector. So clothing might be a big area that's impacted. And honestly, we don't know a lot of these things because how many companies want to say, hey, we get all our parts from China, given the way that global trade looks at these things? Not many, but it's still a really common action. And the reason why is pretty simple. I mean, the profit margins you make in production, producing things in China are insane comparatively to what you can make with domestic production. A lot of that's regulatory prices. I mean, this is a really geeky economic example, but the bottom line is we found someone who could produce everything cheaply, and now their factory's on fire, and we don't have another way to build the things we want. And you can see further proof of this. We talked previously about the Baltic Exchange Dry Index, and I'm mentioning it here again for one other reason. It is sitting as of this moment at 4:30. And it was at a height in September of over 2,500. What this measures is the amount of goods moving around the world. We basically are at 1/6 of the amount of goods moving as we used to be previously. That's important because it means you're not going to get your stuff, okay? So for the second bit of this show, and we'll do this part shorter because I know we're already up on 40-some minutes, is that, and I think this is really important because this is a follow-up to yesterday, and it's also something that's really upsetting to me, and I'm sharing this from digitaltrends.com. Facebook, Amazon, Google teaming up with WHO to stop coronavirus misinformation, and this is from Aaron Mamet, February 16, 4:55 Pacific time, so that'd be, about 8 o'clock on the East Coast of the U.S. What it's saying is, before I go into this, you know, we're told to assume the World Health Organization is a solid actor, but we know that its primary source of funding is the Chinese government, therefore the Chinese Communist Party. We know that from their own statements, they were more concerned with the political ramifications of the disease than actually treating it. And so, in following with the steps we saw from Event 201 and their own internal planning, that what they are doing is they're trying to control information. They said the information fight is more important than the bacteriological fight, or virological fight, rather. And it's absolutely insane, but this is what they're doing. They're basically bureaucrats running to cover their own backsides. The World Health Organization organized a meeting that brought together the likes of Facebook, Amazon, and Google, and there were others there, with the goal of stopping the spread of misinformation about the new coronavirus, officially called COVID-19. The meeting was hosted by Facebook at its Menlo Park, California campus, CNBC reported, citing a spokesperson for the social media company. Other companies represented at the meeting included Airbnb, Dropbox, Kinsa, Mapbox, Salesforce, Twilio, Twitter, Verizon, and YouTube, according to two sources with knowledge of the matter. Apple, Lyft, and Uber were given invitations but did not send representatives. And it's kind of interesting who they're bringing in, right? They're bringing in Airbnb because they want it to look like travel works well. They're bringing in these things like Mapbox so that people don't have maps where they can look at, say, okay, these are the dangerous areas I want to avoid, and Verizon, a major carrier that's out there. So we'll talk about that. Let's see, who shared information with the company regarding its response to the coronavirus while the attendees shared ideas with dealing with the outbreak. The main topic of the meeting was how the companies were working to deal with the, quote, fake news about the coronavirus. WHO's Andy Patterson said the tone is changing as tech firms are starting to ramp up their efforts to stop the spread of misinformation, and he offered to help them in fact-checking information posted on their platforms instead of relying on third-party sources. So, we're from the government, we're here to tell you what's right. Twitter and YouTube and other social media sites are still awash with misinformation. That's what they say, not controlled information. Patterson said, referring to the coronavirus misinformation spread as infodemic. This includes fake news stories on Facebook and other social media platforms, including, I'm sure they would list Coronavirus Central. Books on Amazon that stoke fear about the coronavirus and conspiracy videos on YouTube. The misinformation has allowed hackers to take advantage of the outbreak, spreading malware through emails that are supposedly about the coronavirus. And all right, so let me get real here for a second. In my day-to-day real life, I write books about government suppression of ideas that they don't like, so I happen to know a lot about this particular subject. And what you find is that, and you never really realize it until you're the target of it, is that the governments of this world and the big corporations have certain ideas about the way things should be, and if you run afoul of those ideas and start making too much noise, they find it easier to attack the messenger than they do to confront the message. And think about how people are attacked. Oh, they're conspiracy theorists. They're crackpots. You shouldn't listen to them. And you will see, and if you're someone who is concerned about the coronavirus and you start talking about it, you'll often have people say, well, how come I didn't hear that? How come I wasn't on the news? And it has been recognized, honestly, going back to at least Joseph Goebbels and before that, that in media, the way you control putting out big lies to repeat it over and over again so that people are afraid to pay the social costs for saying truth. Now, that's a very harsh statement I'm making, but I'm sharing it with you because it's absolutely true. And in this case, we have seen consistently the efforts to shut down everyone who speaks against these sorts of ideas and just trying to put information out there about what is happening with this coronavirus. And I think that's very telling. And I will give you an example for this that comes from my own personal life. I run a group on Facebook that is related to cultural and political commentary, and we have been posting a number of articles there. And these articles, just so you know, these come from peer-reviewed information like the New England Journal of Medicine or The Lancet, which is the British equivalent, and I am literally now getting my page threatened from false information found in my group, according to Facebook, by this shadowy group called healthfeedback.org. I've never seen this person before, but all of a sudden in the last week, we have seen over and over attacks against actual scientific research that says, well, you're assessing that this coronavirus may be worse than it actually is. And they take incomplete information, which we freely concede we're spreading because we don't have full information. We can't. And say, well, you're not allowed to put that out there. You're not a recognized source. The only sources are the CDC and the WHO. And what you see is the same sort of communist information control being put out there and groups being threatened for dissolution for trying to spread information to the people. And I could go through, I got at least 7 different articles in my group alone of people just trying to get information out there, and the ones who are seeking the cutting edge of the information are being attacked for their willingness to share information with the people, at the same time that we have seen and we know that the WHO, the CDC, and these public health agencies are making sure that you have only constricted access to information. And that is something that is incredibly upsetting, and we've seen that they have found it easier to silence the messengers rather than to debate the facts. And, you know, look, I understand there are other things that have to happen out there. I understand that, you know, that there's no desire for panic on any side. But what there is a desire for real information. And if you are going to continue to lie to the people, you institutional actors, the governments, the institutions of the world, we're going to have to find things ourselves. And that's what we do in this group. That's why we built an open source intelligence network, so that we can talk to the nurses and the doctors and the first responders out there who are saying, hey, they're saying there are no cases. I hear about these cases. You know, we talked yesterday about a case of a man from Buffalo who was out there saying that he knew of at least 6 cases at Millard Fillmore Hospital in the Kaleida system in Western New York. And now they are, every media's response was to say, we are going to debunk the rumors. There's a case here. This is WKBW in Buffalo. Debunked coronavirus in Western New York rumors, how EMTs are being cautious. And they basically say this guy is lying, and he's sitting there and he's putting out the evidence. He's putting out the call. I'll put up the video of what he said. He had this 13-minute video. His name is Shrimp Zoo on YouTube. Listen to the guy, determine for yourself. But this guy isn't getting anything for this. He's getting attacked. He's getting pilloried. And why? Because he's trying to keep his wife safe, who works at a hospital, because they think that our government is lying to them about the safety of the people in the hospital, the people who are working there. And we know from the first case in China that of the 57 people, of the first 138 who got sick in Wuhan's main hospital, that 40 of them were the health responders. They were the doctors. We know now that the hospital director of the main hospital in Wuhan just died, along with Dr. Li, who was the man who first identified, at least for mass consumption, this outbreak, and who was forced to recant by his government and say he was lying about it. So I am mad about this, and I think we should be too, because we are being lied to, and the people who are telling the truth are being attacked. It's like living in that Aaron Brockovich movie, but that's honestly how we're being treated in this scenario. And I think it's worth listening to the gentleman who was on there. He did his own thing. He offers his own evidence of it, and for what it's worth, I believe it. You know, I live up here in Maine, and we know that there were people who came here from Wuhan in late January that were hidden in a hotel. We even know which hotel it was. And, you know, we're told that they don't have this, but I don't know if that's true or not. I know I won't go within 10 miles of where that hotel is. You know, and for those who don't know, it's in Waterville. You know, then they went to Colby College, and we found out these facts because, you know, we wanted to know. And we know in our state, and I've heard stories from other states, and I don't know the truth. You know, and I don't want to have people be attacked, and I don't want to have us live in an environment of suspicion and mutual mistrust. But what I'm saying is that our governments, through their unwillingness to share information, through their malfeasance in not acting properly to protect the public from the sick, from choosing economic protection over the protection of the health, they have blood on their hands if people get sick from this and people die, including the very people in the medical system we're going to need most. We saw China do that. We expect better from the United States of America, and frankly, we're not getting it. And that makes me mad. That makes me incredibly mad. So if you have stories about this, I'm going to put them on the air, and we're going to investigate every one of them, because you know what? One story might be true. 2 stories might be, you know, untrue. That's possible. I believe that. But when you start hearing about dozens of stories of people who are going out there, who know about these people who are quarantined or who are pulled aside, and you're saying it's all the flu, I'm sorry, but I just don't believe that. A tenth of humanity isn't under lockdown because we're facing the flu. And, you know, ultimately, governments are going to have to get through a very hard time. I get that. If we don't trust you, it's not going to work. And, you know, I say this as a dissident. I mean, that's what I do in my daily life, right? But ultimately, you have to come clean with the people. Let us know what is happening. We may not need to know every detail, but don't lie to us. Don't gaslight us. And that's what we're going to look at. So we're going to go look for more information. We'll see what the news brings tomorrow. I intend on doing a deeper search into what's happening in Japan. That's going to be my focal point, as well as trying to reach out to some more people. I want to say thank you to everyone who has been tuning into this broadcast. We're going to keep going every day, except for Sundays, because I take off, because this is a lot of work to compile all this. But as we go through this and we see some of these issues that are happening out there, we always want to try to focus on some positive things that can be worked on. And one of the things I really want people to take a look at is, what is their store of basic pharmaceuticals that you can get that you would need for things? Please make sure you have some aspirin in hand, some ibuprofen. You know, these are things you can use against inflammation, especially for the ibuprofen. You want to be careful, apparently, because that can agitate with a reinfection of coronavirus with respect to the problems with the blood pressure. But you want to have a basic selection of certain things, some Benadryl for treatment. And I always tell people, make sure you put basic things together. There's a number of really good guides out there. If you look at My Surviving Coronavirus on any budget, it offers a number of very smart ways to go about this. But you're going to want to have that sort of information available. And these are things you can do very inexpensively. I honestly think you probably have no more than 2 weeks to kind of get the supplies you want. You may have as little as 1 week. We really don't know, and I can't tell you how fast it's going to go, because not only do we have this long infection period, which we know is at least 24 days from the studies that are out there, but the reality is, in a healthier environment like the United States, it may be the risk of reinfection that's greater. And I worry, you know, from the perspective of someone who considers at least the possibility this could be a biological weapon, that this long latency phase that we're dealing with, where people are getting infected the first time and perhaps not having too bad of an occurrence, is very troubling, because it means a lot of people are going to be sick and capable of being reinfected. And that our government, maybe because they don't want to deal with the economic consequence, is wittingly or unwittingly facilitating this advance. And I talked to a lot of people who have read statistics, especially based on the ACE2 pathway, that saying that, you know, well, this is something that only impacts Asians. This is something that, you know, hasn't affected, you know, Caucasians or Africans or people of Latino ancestry to the same extent. And while that may presently be true, please do not count on that to save you, because every bit of medical evidence suggests that, in fact, the real determining factor is, in fact, the quality of air and respiratory function, which is a unique problem to Asia given its air quality. But nonetheless, in the secondary infection, it is those people with the healthiest immune systems who may be most at risk. And that would include a lot of people living in the developed first world of the West. So we don't want anyone to get sick here or there. Please do not count on that to save you. Instead, push for transparency and make sure you hold your representatives to account. It's time for things to start getting out there. You know, they called Senator Tom Cotton, who has spoken publicly of the need to understand what happened with this, fake news for asking questions. Don't let them do the same to you. Don't let them gaslight you. So with that, I want to close today's show, say thank you for listening in. We will be back tomorrow. We'll have much more of a review of what's happening on the ground. Hopefully, I might include some information about what the quarantine conditions are like in the U.S. as opposed to China, as well as a review of what's happening with Japan and that cruise ship, and any other news that breaks, and we'll see what's out there. But as from today, make sure you have the goods you need now. Today's a good day to go do it. Don't wait till tomorrow to do what you can do today. We close, as always, with a prayer here that the Lord may have mercy on the sick, on the children, on the elderly, on all those people who are in need and who need help in these terrible moments of this disease, and that He may give courage and patience to those who are asking questions like we are. A lot of people are going to get on you pretty hard if you keep asking these questions, but do not stop. There is a reason that we see nearly a billion people impacted directly by this disease. Do not let the lies of governments and of actors who let their fears override their reason prevent you from doing what you need to do to protect you and yours in these troubling times. So we will see you tomorrow. All episodes, as always, are up at coronaviruscentral.net. I'll have this up on the various platforms within a half hour. And just keep safe. God bless.